2005 Sunstone Symposium West presents Session 11, Joseph Smith, William Miller, Ellen G. White, and Mary Baker Eddy, Four American Prophets' Perspectives on Slavery, Race, and Ethnicity. Presentation by Newell Bringhurst with a response by Levina Fielding Anderson.
Hello. This is session number 11, Joseph Smith, William Miller, Ellen G. White, and Mary Baker Eddy, Four American Prophets' Perspectives on Slavery, Race, and Ethnicity. The presenter is Newell Bringhurst, who will be responded to by Levina Fielding Anderson. Before we begin, just a couple notes. This is by in ticket or name tag only. No gate crashers, please. Also, we ask you that you turn off all cell phones, pagers, alarm clocks, any other noisemakers you have on you. With that, I will introduce our speakers. Newell Bringhurst is a teacher of American history and government at the College of the Sequoias in the San Joaquin Valley in California. He earned his BA in history from the University of Utah and his PhD from UC Davis. He's the author of numerous books, including Saints, Slaves, and Blacks, The Changing Place of Black People Within Mormonism. He also wrote a biography of Vaughn Brody, co-edited the book Black and Mormon with Darren Smith. His initial groundwork for blacks in the Mormon Church comes from an autobiography of Brigham Young called Brigham Young and the Expanding Mormon Frontier, almost all of which, I am assured, are available at the end of this hallway. He's also written a few local histories. He'll be responded to by Levina Fielding Anderson, who is an editor, runs the company Editing Incorporated, has a PhD in English from the University of Washington, bachelor's degree from BYU. She is a president of, has been a president of the Association for Mormon Letters, is the associate editor of Dialogue, has been an editor for Ensign, and has her books include Lucy's book, the critical edition of Lucy Mack Smith's family memoir, and has edited many, many others. And we'll turn the time over to Newell.
When I saw Christian up here introducing me, I think of, boy, how time marches on. I can remember the first time that I saw Christian. He was just a toddler. And, you know, I just realized how many years have gone by. And in a kind of another nostalgic note, this is actually, it was actually 18 years ago from this time that I first presented a paper at Sunstone West, and it was based on what became my Vaughn Brody presentation. Anybody here, were they here at this the first Sunstone West, which was, I think, at the Berkeley Marina in 1987, I believe it was. I don't know. You were there. Okay. And I remember that very vividly, the first Sunstone West symposium. And so I'm grateful for being able to use this venue to vet and test ideas for works that are in progress, and I'm hoping that this will be the vanguard of a larger work, which is down the line. And I look forward to your comments and critique on what I have to say. I sort of look with trepidation on what Levina has to say, and I apologize in advance for giving her a 26-page version of the remarks. But mercifully for you, it's not going to be 27 pages long. I've managed to distill it down to a 35-minute presentation, and I will try to get through this as quickly as possible. Noted American religious historian Sidney E. Eilstrom has characterized Mormonism, along with Seventh-day Adventism, the Christian Scientists, Jehovah's Witnesses, and Pentecostalism as, quote, five large and easily differentiated religious movements that bear the stamp made in America. The leaders of each of these indigenous religions, spawned in America's environment of religious pluralism, have been compelled to confront the long festering problems of racial discrimination involving African Americans. At the root of such discrimination was the institution of black slavery, which flourished in anti-American, antebellum America, Confronting black slavery was Joseph Smith, along with the three founder prophets of two other indigenous American religions, namely William Miller and Ellen G. White, the progenitors of Seventh-day Adventism, and Mary Baker Eddy, founder of Christian Science. Beginning in the 1830s, Smith, Miller, White, and Eddy, all New England natives, were caught up in the increasing controversy over slavery. Joseph Smith Jr., the Vermont-born founder and prophet, seer, and revelator of the LDS Church, the oldest and largest of these indigenous religions, commented extensively on slavery. Smith, through the pages of the Book of Mormon, expressed views that clearly condemned human servitude. Smith's work focused on antagonisms between the light-skinned Nephites and dark-skinned Lamanites. This work, written from the perspective of the Nephites, proclaimed that it was against, quote, against the law of our brethren, that there should be any slaves among them, or that ye make slaves of one another. Book of Mormon Nephites refused to enslave the less favored dark-skinned Lamanites. Neither do we desire to bring anyone into the yoke of bondage. In fact, the idolatrous Lamanites were the ones who practiced slavery and made repeated efforts to enslave the divinely chosen Nephites. Lamanite slaveholding was cited as proof of that people's, the Lamanites' wicked and ferocious nature. Joseph Smith's anxieties concerning African American slavery were more directly expressed in the doctrine to all nations. More ominous, black slaves would be involved in these cataclysmic events. Quote, and it shall come to pass that after many days, slaves shall rise up against their masters, who shall be marshaled and disciplined for war. The Mormon leader also expressed anti-slavery sentiments in a second Doctrine and Covenants revelation. This one received in December 1833. Quote, it is not right that any man should be in bondage one to another. However, within 2 years, Joseph Smith embraced a pro-slavery position, clearly at variance with his earlier anti-slavery sentiments. An August 1835 statement approved by a General Assembly of the Church as official policy affirmed that, quote, we do not believe it right to interfere with bondservants, neither preach the gospel to, nor meddle with, nor influence them in the least to be dissatisfied with their situations in this life, thereby jeopardizing the lives of men. This declaration, initially published in the Latter-day Saints Messenger and Advocate, the Church's official newspaper, was approved by Joseph Smith, receiving further sanctification through inclusion in the Doctrine and Covenants. 3 months later, in November 1835, Smith addressed a letter to the elders of the Church in which he quoted pro-slavery scripture as contained in the Old Testament, admonishing, quote, servants, obey in all things your masters according to the flesh, not with eye service as men pleasers, but in singleness of heart, fearing God. As for elders to whom this letter was addressed, the Mormon leader cautioned missionaries to avoid going unto slaves or servants unless granted permission by the master. In April 1836, Joseph Smith reiterated support for slavery in a lengthy front-page editorial published in the Latter-day Saint Messenger and Advocate, in which he declared, we Latter-day Saints have no right to interfere with slaves contrary to the mind and will of their masters. He then went on to give scriptural legitimacy to his position, quoting from both the Old and New Testaments. In particular, the Mormon leader cited passages from Genesis, sanctioning the holding of the sons of Ham in servitude. And he said, cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants he shall be unto his brethren. Affirming such scriptural support, Smith further editorialized, I cannot say that the curse is not yet taken off the sons of Canaan, neither will it until affected by as great a power as caused it to come. You might ask why. Why was there this shift from an anti to a pro-slavery position? I feel that there were three primary reasons for this. First and foremost were conditions surrounding Latter-day Saint settlement in the slave state of Missouri during the period 1831-39. Commencing with the arrival of the first Mormons in Jackson County in January 1831, Smith was commanded by revelation to gather his followers and build the saints' New Jerusalem in preparation for the millennium and second coming. The overwhelming majority of Smith's followers were from older, more settled, non-slaveholding states of the Northeast and Midwest, whereas their non-Mormon Missouri neighbors were largely Southern in their background, eking out a relatively primitive existence in the rough frontier environment of Western Missouri. Thus, Mormon settlers were forced to confront conditions alien to what they were accustomed, including the institution of black slavery. This resulting clash of cultures was most vividly illustrated in the forced expulsion of the Saints from Jackson County into neighboring Clay County in August of 1833. Non-Mormon residents of Jackson County, in justifying their actions, circulated a so-called secret constitution in which they accused the Saints of, quote, tampering with our slaves and endeavoring to sow dissensions amongst them. Mormon settlement in Clay County, unfortunately, also proved temporarily, for in June 1836, the Latter-day Saints were compelled to flee once more further north, taking up residence in the relatively unsettled counties of Caldwell and Davis. Among the reasons cited for the Mormons' expulsion from Clay by local non-Mormons was that they, the Latter-day Saints, are non-slaveholders opposed to slavery. In March 1838, Joseph Smith, along with his immediate family, arrived in Far West, taking up residence in that community, thereby establishing Northwest Missouri as Mormonism's primary gathering place. But there was also a second reason for Joseph Smith shifting to a pro-slavery position, and this was the fact that the Latter-day Saints were expanding missionary activity into the slaveholding South. Prior to 1835 and the adoption of the church's official position on preaching to the slaves, very little missionary work had been done in the South. But in 1836, Joseph Smith, anxious to preach, Mormon missionary work in this region, cautioned, quote, it would be much better and more prudent not to preach at all to the slaves until after the masters are converted. By 1840, at least 9 Southern slaveholders had converted to Mormonism, owning between them some 50 black slaves. The earliest known instance of Mormon slaveholding in Missouri was in 1836, when an unnamed Southern convert arrived at Far West with his single black slave. Eventually, nearly 200 Southern Saints emigrated to the Mormon regions of Northwest Missouri. The total number of slaves owned by and brought to Missouri by these individuals is unknown. But among the known Mormon slaveholders in Missouri was one Levi Taylor, who along with his wife Ann owned a total of 9 slaves, 4 males and 5 females. And that's a pretty large number of slaves because slaves were considered as expensive property. So Taylor's wife, incidentally, was the daughter of a well-known 19th century Latter-day Saint, Abraham O. Smoot, whom some of you might have heard of. He also has a big administration building named after him down on the BYU campus, which is next door to where Paul works at the museum down. I thought I'd bring the rest of the family into this. But anyway, Just, you know, a little bit of, you know, since Paul's not here, I was thinking of him. But anyway, more noteworthy is the apparent fact that Joseph Smith himself owned a black slave, or at least utilized the domestic services of an African American during his Missouri sojourn. But Joseph Smith was also influenced by a third factor in affirming a pro-slavery position, and this was a very strong desire to disassociate himself and the church from the extremely unpopular abolitionist movement. If you know anything about American history during this period, the abolitionists were considered as the wild-eyed radicals of this period, and the opposition of the abolitionists was almost as strong in the North as it was in the South in the period before the American Civil War. And this is evident in Smith's lengthy pro-slavery editorial in the April 1836 Latter-day Saint Messenger and Advocate. And this editorial was prompted in large measure by the visit to Kirtland of an individual by the name of James J. Alvord, who was an abolitionist, an organizer for the American Anti-Slavery Society. And he later reported that his doctrines of liberty, as he termed them, were received kindly by the Mormon-dominated community, and he proceeded to organize a chapter of the Abolitionist Society consisting of 86 members, which is a pretty goodly number for that time. Well, Joseph Smith reacted very quickly to this development, stating emphatically that very few Latter-day Saints were involved, and that Alvord had presented his arguments to, quote, nearly naked walls. That's how he termed it. But 86 people, I guess that's more people than we've got in the room right now, so I wouldn't consider it nearly naked walls. The Mormon leader went on to denounce abolitionism in general, asserting that he did not believe that the people of the North had any more right to say that the South shall not hold slaves than the South shall say the North shall hold slaves. He then asserted that abolitionism was, quote, calculated to set loose upon the world a community of people, i.e. blacks, who might overrun our country and violate the most sacred principles of society, chastity and virtue. And we know what that's a code word for, miscegenation. Well, Joseph Smith's position shifted dramatically once more after the Latter-day Saints were expelled from Missouri and settled in Nauvoo, Illinois in 1839. By this time, Joseph Smith assumed an anti-slavery position somewhat reminiscent of that he had promoted prior to 1835. In 1842, Smith, through the pages of the Times and Seasons, the church's officially Nauvoo-based paper, which he himself edited, called for, quote, universal liberty in endorsing the activities of anti-slavery advocates. And in 1844, 2 years later, he promoted his anti-slavery views as proposed national policy, public policy, in his short-lived campaign for president of the United States. As a self-styled third-party candidate pitted against Democrat James K. Polk and Whig Henry Clay, Smith adopted a platform, views on the government and policies of the United States. His platform called for the breakdown of slavery and removal of the shackles from the poor black man. In his program based on compensated emancipation, the Mormon leader admonished Southern citizens to petition their respective state legislatures to approve the necessary funding and enabling legislation. The financing needed would be obtained through the sale of public lands. Smith believed that his program could bring about the complete elimination of American slavery by the year 1850. But alas, the assassination of Joseph Smith on the 27th of June, 1844, ended his presidential campaign on a sudden tragic note. The actual popularity of Joseph Smith's program will never be known. In certain respects, his proposals were similar to and reminiscent of those earlier made by Thomas Jefferson, Henry Clay, as well as the American Colonization Society. More evident is that Joseph Smith, through his shifting views on slavery, left a mixed legacy for Mormonism, vividly illustrated in the contrasting views of Brigham Young and Joseph Smith III, each claiming the mantle of the slain Mormon leader. Young, as leader of those Mormons who migrated to the Great Basin, embraced anti-abolitionist pro-slavery beliefs, reminiscent of those, and in many ways moving far beyond those expressed by Joseph Smith during the 1830s. Under Young's leadership, the Utah Territorial Legislature in 1852 legalized black slavery, the only Western territory to do so. Utah black slavery remained firmly entrenched until abolished, not by territorial statute, but by federal law in 1862. By contrast, Joseph Smith III, son of the Mormon prophet, who emerged by 1860 as leader of the reorganized church, embraced an anti-slavery, pro-abolitionist position, strikingly similar to that assumed by his father during the 1840s. Coming of age in Nauvoo during the late 1840s and in the 1850s, the younger Smith was strongly influenced by growing anti-slavery sentiment in Illinois and throughout the North. As the younger Smith became politically active, he aligned himself with the Republicans because of that party's strong anti-slavery stance. Now, moving beyond Joseph Smith and his LDS successors, two principal leaders identified with American Adventism, namely William Miller and Ellen G. White, also made public their views on slavery during the antebellum period. The views of Miller and White, in turn, influenced policies involving slavery and ultimately race within American Adventism, an emerging indigenous denomination, which, like Mormonism, was highly visible both before and after the Civil War. William Miller, like Joseph Smith, was a New England native, born on the 15th of February, 1782, in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, which would make him about 20 years older than Joseph. He lived most of his life in two small villages on the borders of Vermont and New York. Also like Smith, Miller had limited formal education, initially eking out a living as a poor farmer before joining American forces fighting in the War of 1812. In his religious beliefs, Miller was initially a seeker, first embracing deism and then becoming a Calvinist Baptist, apparently caught up in the religious fervor of the Second Great Awakening, as was Joseph Smith. Miller also undertook intense study of the Bible, drawn particularly to the apocalyptic books, especially the book of Daniel, whereby he became convinced that the advent leading to the end times and second coming of Jesus would occur in or about 1843. Miller began lecturing on the advent in 1831, and over the next decade, he enlisted a following that at its peak included 50,000 adherents, which dwarfed the fledgling Mormon movement at the same time. They were competing for adherents. Although Miller was a committed anti-slavery man, he initially expressed anti-abolitionist views during the 1830s. In an 1834 account, he denounced, quote, the abolitionist as fire-skulled, visionary, fanatical, treasonable, suicidal, demoralizing, and hot-headed. That's William Miller. So you know, it's not hard to tell where he stood on the abolitionists. So it sort of parallels a little bit what Joseph Smith was saying at the same time. But after 1840, again paralleling Joseph Smith, he became more sympathetic to the anti-slavery cause. In doing so, as I say, he seemed to parallel the behavior of Joseph Smith. Although Miller was labeled a reliable and practical abolitionist, he and his followers avoided involvement in any and all reform associations, including the abolitionists, presenting themselves as apolitical apocalyptics, looking instead towards the millennium and second coming as the only means of reforming society. Thus, Miller, in sharp contrast to Joseph Smith, was unwilling to actively promote anti-slavery in the political arena as public policy. By 1844, Miller and his followers had fixed a precise date that the Advent would begin. That date was set as October 22nd, 1844. That would be the day that everything would come to an end, or begin to come to an end. However, this date came and went without incident. This so-called great disappointment, as it is known, followed by Miller's own death shortly thereafter, ended the Millerite phase of Adventism. But despite the great disappointment, some 50,000 people still considered themselves Adventists, divided by a dozen different doctrines. In some ways, you can see that there's a parallel similarity to what happened within Mormonism following the death of Joseph Smith. The largest Adventist faction came under the control of a triumvirate of three individuals: Joseph Bates, James White, and his wife Ellen G. White. Ellen G. White assumed the Adventist's most crucial role as the movement's seer or prophet, who used her visions to confirm, reinforce, and extend developing doctrines within the movement. Her role in Adventism clearly paralleled that of Joseph Smith within Mormonism. Ellen Gould Harmon, a native New Englander, was born in Gorham, Maine, on the 26th of November, 1827, as a twin. At age 9, Ellen suffered a broken nose and other facial injuries as a result of a heavy stone thrown and hit her by an angry classmate. This resulted in extreme physical disfigurement, along with difficulty in breathing and other chronic health problems. These problems compelled young Ellen to suspend her formal education after completing just 3 grades. Psychologically, she became withdrawn and sensitive. She found solace in her religious faith and, as an adolescent, embraced Adventism. Over time, Ellen, along with her husband and other Adventist leaders, developed a set of distinctive beliefs and practices which brought cohesion to the Adventist movement. During the 1850s and early 1860s, Ellen, along with other Adventists, promoted their core doctrine of millenarian Adventism. That is, a fundamental belief that the end times were near, interpreting the growing national division over slavery and the coming of the Civil War as clear signs of the times. White was an outspoken abolitionist sympathetic to the Union cause. White viewed the slavery issue in eschatological terms. She saw the evil of American slavery combined with the complacency of other American religious denominations in its continued existence, and I guess she'd include the Mormons, the Utah Latter-day Saints, was, quote, a chief indication of a decaying world. In an 1858 essay entitled The Sins of Babylon, White condemned slavery as an abomination in the eyes of God. Quote, all heaven beholds with indignation human beings reduced by their fellow men to the lowest paths of degradation. She then went on to issue the following apocalyptic prophecy and warning. And let me just read this. It's a little bit lengthy, and I hope I plead for your indulgence here. Quote, God will restrain his angels but a little longer. His wrath burns against this nation, and especially the religious bodies that have themselves engaged in slavery. The cries of the oppressed have reached unto heaven, and angels stand amazed at the untold agonized sufferings which man, formed in the image of his maker, causes his fellow man. God's anger will not cease until he has caused this land of light to drink the dregs of the cup of his fury. Unquote. This sort of reminds me a little bit of Jonathan Edwards' Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. I'm sure some of you are probably familiar with that. This is almost a paraphrase in many ways, the cadence and everything else. Those of you who are familiar with the writings of Jonathan Edwards. During the Civil War itself, White further declared that, quote, God is punishing this nation for the high crime of slavery. He has the destiny of the nation in his hands. He will punish the South for the sin of slavery and the North for so long suffering its overreaching and overbearing influence. Even though White and her fellow Adventists were anti-slavery radical Republicans, they refused to vote or participate in the political process. Adventists also refused to fight in the Civil War. Thus, Ellen White, in declaring her Adventist disdain for slavery while at the same time affirming a refusal to fight in the Civil War, adopted a position remarkably similar to that of Joseph Smith III and the Reorganized Church. At the same time, the Adventist position, anti-slavery position, stood in sharp contrast to the pro-slavery position of Joseph Smith and his Great Basin Founders. Finally, we come to Mary Baker Eddy, founder of the Christian Science. Even though the Church of Christ Scientists was not formally organized as a distinct denomination until 1875, some 10 years after the Civil War and the ending of African-American slavery, Baker's attitudes on slavery are significant, I feel, in that they influenced practices and policies developed within the movement she founded. Born on the 16th of July, 1821, in Bow, New Hampshire, Mary Morse Baker was almost an exact contemporary of fellow New England-born church founder Ellen G. White. Like White, Baker as a youth suffered from chronic health problems, specifically spinal and nervous ailments. This made it difficult for her to attend school regularly, thus adversely affecting her formal education, again mirroring the situation of Ellen White. Indeed, Baker, like White, would experience chronic health problems during her entire life. In fact, Baker's whole life, to quote one of her biographers, involved, quote, a vain search for good health and thus a preoccupation with illness and wellness that helped shape her later religious beliefs. Baker, however, was both resourceful and talented. By the age of 12, she was writing verse, something she would continue to do for the remainder of her life. Her father, Mark Baker, was a reasonably prosperous farmer, a devout member of the Congregational Church, and politically active and involved. Young Mary was exposed to the political views of her father and older brother, Albert, both of whom were staunch states' rights Democrats. Mark and Albert Baker also expressed views on slavery and abolition, which in turn influenced young Mary as she came of age during the 1830s. Both Mark and Albert Baker looked upon the abolitionists as disruptors of the Union. That was during the 1830s. In addition, Mary was directly exposed to the South's peculiar institution as a result of her brief marriage to George Washington Grover and the young couple's subsequent short sojourn in South Carolina. Grover, although a native New Englander, had previously moved to Charleston, achieving wealth as a builder and contractor. However, shortly after their arrival in South Carolina, George Grover became gravely ill, with yellow fever and died in June of 1844. The young couple had just been married for a mere 6 months, and Mary was pregnant with the couple's first child. It's unclear whether George owned any African American slaves. In her own recollections written many years later, Mary asserted that her husband was, quote, considerably wealthy, but much of his property was in slaves, and I declined to sell them at his decease in 1844, for I could never believe that a human being was my property, unquote. This is a quote made many, many years later. The factual basis of this assertion is shaky at best. More certain is that Grover hired slaves for his construction business. As for house slaves, it is unlikely that Grover had any, although it is possible that Grover may have had a body servant for himself and a personal maid for his wife. Also highly questionable is Mary Baker's later claims that she, quote, did all I could to teach and preach abolition while living in South Carolina. Also doubtful is her assertion that she, quote, wrote vigorous articles published in the Southern press attacking slavery. In fact, Mary remained a loyal states' rights Democrat throughout the 1840s and into the 1850s. However, by the eve of the American Civil War, Mary Baker's political allegiance shifted dramatically, her attitudes towards slavery as well. She joined the fledgling Republican Party. With the outbreak of war in 1861, she became an enthusiastic vocal supporter of Abraham Lincoln and the Union cause. Possibly influencing Mary's change of attitude was involvement in the war by the two most important men in her life. The first was her husband, Daniel Patterson, whom she had married in 1853. Patterson was commissioned in 1862 by the governor of New Hampshire to help Northern sympathizers in the South. Unfortunately, he was captured by Confederates and placed in a Southern prison where he remained for almost a year. The second individual was her son, George Grover, whom she had borne from her first marriage. In 1861, young George, at the time just barely 15 years of age, volunteered to fight in the Union Army. Mary Patterson, in turn, publicly supported the war through her written poems and prose published in various periodicals. She wrote articles defending liberty and democracy while at the same time excoriating whom she termed the hydra-headed copperheads. In poetry, she encouraged the enlistment of soldiers, extolling, quote, sacrifice, duty, and honor. It was better to die nobly than to live in shame. Following the Civil War, Mary Patterson's major concern was not slavery per se, which had been completely abolished through the 13th Amendment. Rather, she was concerned about her failing marriage and continuing chronic health problems. Her marriage to the economically unstable and habitually unfaithful Daniel Patterson ended in 1866. For her health problems, she sought various types of treatment, including those provided by Phineas Parkhurst Quimbley. She studied with Quimbley, I have trouble with that name, and was greatly influenced by his ideas on mental healing. These in turn helped provide a foundation for her emerging Christian Science beliefs. Over the following decade, Mary Baker Eddy, as she was now known, for in 1877 she had married for the third time, Asha Gilbert Eddy, undertook research and writing for what would become Science and Health, Key to the Scriptures, her most important work. Science and Health, first published in 1876, was destined to be the foundational work for Christian Science, formally organized as a denomination shortly thereafter. Science and Health became, quote, one of the most influential books ever written by an American, this according to American religious historian Paul Konkin, comparable to the Book of Mormon brought forth by Joseph Smith. Through the pages of Science and Health, Eddy revealed her strong anti-slavery views, albeit seemingly belated given the complete abolition of African-American slavery some 10 years earlier. Quote, "Slavery is not the legitimate state of man. God made men free. The omnipotence of divine justice," she asserted, "was crucial in breaking the despotic fetters and abolishing the whipping post and the slave market." She acknowledged that efforts to legally abolish unpaid servitude in the United States had been difficult. But she went on to say the more difficult task was what she termed the current condition of mental slavery, which mortal beings currently found themselves in. She characterized this new form of slavery, quote, as the bondage of sickness, sin, and death. The voice of God demanded that the fetters of sin, sickness, and death be stricken from the human mind, and that its freedom be won not through warfare, not with the bayonet and blood, but through Christ's divine science, unquote. The abolition of this mental slavery, she confessed, would be a more difficult task than the abolition of African slavery during the previous decade. In conclusion, Mary Baker Eddy, along with Ellen G. White, William Miller, and Joseph Smith, as leaders of three major indigenous American religions, were each strongly affected by the existence of black slavery in antebellum America. This despite the fact that all four were native New Englanders, with each coming of age in an environment far removed from the South's peculiar institution. The way in which each of these four prophetic leaders responded and the attitudes that each developed directly affected policies, practices, along with basic theological beliefs within all three denominations, the lasting effects which continue to be felt long after the complete abolition of slavery in 1865. Thank you.
I really want us to have some time for questions and answers, so I'm going to cut my brilliant three-page introduction on the religious implications of slavery and cut straight to the chase, which is that Newell has done the best job of anyone I know in pointing out that Joseph Smith's thought underwent a significant evolution, which we usually do not acknowledge, in his attitudes towards slavery. Assuming that Joseph Smith believed the doctrines that he translated in the Book of Mormon and which he received as revelations in the Doctrine and Covenants, he began his public career religiously and doctrinally opposed to slavery. And these views were harmonious with revelations received up through 1835. The second stage was a sharp switch that is an interesting revisiting of and reincorporation of Stephen Taggart's Missouri thesis, which, though mistaken about its formative influence on the priesthood ban for blacks, seems to have accurately identified Joseph Smith's responsiveness to economic and political conditions. As a result, Smith established a more pragmatic but decidedly less egalitarian policy on slavery. Sterling Adams' review of Black and Mormon, the collection of essays that Newell and his co-editor Daryl Smith have just published, points out that Newell does not deal with the Book of Mormon and the Doctrine and Covenants in establishing Joseph Smith's pre-Missouri attitudes, even though Newell's introductory essay in that volume is titled The Missouri Thesis Revisited. Sterling lists 36 references from these two Mormon scriptures as a partial list of pro-equality doctrine. This review will be coming out in the summer issue of the Journal of Mormon History, which, of course, you will all want to subscribe to. So Newell's treatment in this presentation and his forthcoming presentation at the Mormon History Association in Vermont next month is a genuine contribution to our understanding of Joseph Smith's development. As Newell points out, however, Joseph Smith repudiated the attempt to accommodate slave owning and make a place for Mormonism in the South. His Nauvoo position was decidedly more harmonious with the earlier theologically based belief. It was not a simple reversion, however, but an attempt to solve some of the political and economic problems posed by slavery that he had observed firsthand in Missouri. Smith, as a U.S. presidential candidate, proposed a program of compensated emancipation, as Newell puts it, even though financing it with the sale of government lands probably would not have been fiscally sound. We tend to draw most of our stories about Joseph Smith's egalitarianism from the Nauvoo period, the ordinations of Elijah Abel and Samuel Chambers, for instance, the heroic story of Jane Manning James, and the tale of Joseph Smith fining a black man for breaking the law but then giving him his own horse so that the man could sell it and pay the fine. Newell documents in this count an absolutely new story to me from the Missouri period that Joseph Smith might have been a slave owner himself, or at least had access to the services of a African American. The good stuff is in the footnote, which he did not read to you, so I will. It comes from Thomas B. Marsh's affidavit made at Richmond shortly before the Hans Mill Massacre and the Siege of Far West. In discussing the Mormon evacuation of Millport, Marsh states, "When Lyman White returned from Millport and informed Joseph Smith that the people were gone and the property left, Smith asked him if they had left any of the Negroes for them," which might have been a jocular comment, "and White replied, 'No,' upon which someone laughed and said to Smith, 'You have lost your Negro then.'" Marsh apparently did not explain the statement any further, and I'm not sure that what could have been a joke constitutes actual documentation that Joseph Smith owned a slave, but it certainly merits following up on. The story of Jane Manning James has some unexplored ambiguities that I hope Newell will treat further as he develops his book. Jane has well-deserved heroic stature, powered by spiritual experience, determinedly leading her family to Nauvoo, stoically enduring hardship, discrimination, and pain to reach her city of Zion, then doing the whole thing over again in coming to Utah. Margaret Blair Young and Darius A. Gray have focused on the dramatic possibilities of her life in the first volume of their trilogy, Standing on the Promises, with its spin-off play I Am Jane and the statue erected in Jane's honor in the Salt Lake City Cemetery. Both poignant and powerful is the account of Jane's promised sealing as Joseph and Emma's daughter, a sealing that was denied her almost until the end of her life, when by Joseph F. Smith's grudging and often delayed permission, she was sealed to Joseph and Emma as a servant. It's the nature of that sealing that I want to invite Newell to consider in greater detail. According to Jane's interview published in the Young Woman's Journal, while she was working in Joseph and Emma's home for her board and room, Emma had her wash Joseph's temple robes. Jane says, "I pondered over them and thought about them so earnestly that the Spirit made manifest to me that they pertain to the new name that is given to the saints that the world knows not of." Immediately afterwards, in fact in the same paragraph, she talks about sitting and discussing Mormonism with Emily and Eliza Partridge and Mariah and Sarah Lawrence, all four of whom were plural wives of Joseph Smith, and, what is more important, briefly with Emma's knowledge, although she did not know that Joseph had already married the Partridge sisters, and Emma's consent, although Emma soon withdrew it. Jane's narrative reads, "Sarah said, 'What would you think if a man had more wives than one?' I said, 'That is all right.' Mariah said, 'Well, we are all four Brother Joseph's wives.' I jumped up and clapped my hands and said, 'That's good.' Sarah said, 'She is all right. Just listen. She believes it all now.'" Jane obviously had less trouble accepting polygamy than many of Joseph Smith's brides. Then she continues, "Sister Emma asked me one day if I would like to be adopted to them as their child. I did not answer her. She said, 'I will wait a while and let you consider it.' She waited 2 weeks before she asked me again. When she did, I told her, 'No, ma'am,' because I did not understand or know what it meant. They were always good and kind to me, but I did not know my own mind. I did not comprehend." Most of the attention up to this point has focused on the injustice between what Jane was offered and what she finally, gradually, grudgingly was given. But what everybody seems to overlook is that either type of sealing is, to my knowledge, absolutely unprecedented. even though a man could be sealed to another man during the Nauvoo period as his son, the only form of sealing involving women in Nauvoo was as plural wives. Parent-child sealings did not occur until Utah. I'm completely unaware of any dyad in which women negotiated a mother-daughter sealing. If a woman wanted an eternal relationship with another woman, it was a triangular one, formulated when they were both sealed to the same man as his wives. So what's going on here? Was Emma recruiting Jane, then in her early 20s, as another plural wife for Joseph? If so, it was definitely the only time Emma did, although Joseph frequently had other people make initial overtures to his proposed plural wives. Even more speculatively, could it be that Emma, who at one point threatened Joseph that she would take a plural husband to see how he liked polygamy then, was she recruiting as a plural wife a woman she was sure Joseph would reject? And I don't think this possibility is realistic, if only because it would have been uncharacteristically cruel of Emma in her relationship with Jane, and uncharacteristically masochistic of Emma to have placed herself in such a humiliating position. However, it is true that young women who lived in Joseph's household, at least four more beyond the four we've already mentioned, or who worked for the family, were quite likely to receive a proposal of plural marriage. Why not Jane? I've exhausted my time on this point, which may turn out to be only another speculative red herring, but there's another parallel among the founders of these three religious movements. All of them, in addition to being New England and Englanders and therefore presumably proposed with a propensity toward democracy, but also hierarchical religion, were maimed or suffered debilitating health problems to some extent in their youth or childhood. The chronic health problems of both Mary Baker Eddy and Ellen White were new to me, and I immediately thought of Joseph Smith's boyhood triple leg surgeries. I would invite Newell to consider not only the psychological implications, but also the theological implications of these socially isolating and traumatizing conditions. What do they say about definitions of power, submission, and chosenness? Is it better to be special in a negative way, such as suffering, than not to be special at all? I wonder. And again, I thank Newell for proposing such interesting topics for our attention.
I guess we have some time for questions, and in asking the questions, I would urge you to come to the microphone since this session is being recorded. Joel, come on.
Just an aside, Dr. Bringhurst was talking about William Miller and his disappointment. In 1843, he told everybody that the second coming was at hand. Didn't happen. So he told them he'd missed it a year. So they waited up the next year, 1844. What was the sociological effect of this? Well, everybody was laughing at them. So it made them cling closer together, these eventual founders of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. I was taking a class in sociology at Berkeley, and the teacher admired a book by a guy named Festinger from Stanford called When Prophecy Failed, and he wondered if people would have the same reaction in our day and age, so he was infiltrating some end-of-the-world groups. So my teacher thought, I'll try this. So he infiltrated a flying saucer group, and there were a dozen people. There were a dozen people in it, but one guy seemed pretty smart, so he took him aside, and he said, isn't it true you're a professor like me, and you're studying this group? And this guy admitted it. He said, well, let's do a paper together. And by the time they finished their studies, they found that 7 out of the 12 were professors.
Toby, go ahead.
I wonder a little just briefly, in Joseph Smith's 2 or 3 year period when he was defending slavery, did he ever make reference to the status of blacks before they came to this world and as a justification for it?
Well, the doctrine of pre-existence was just beginning to be developed, but it wasn't until later that the emphatic statements about the status of blacks in the pre-existence was made. This didn't come until late in the Nauvoo period and in the Utah period. And so as far as the status of blacks, and this is the interesting thing in doing this study, particularly in the wake of the post-1978 revelation, is that it's easier to look at Joseph Smith as being pro-slavery without saying, hey, maybe there was a link between a black priesthood or not, because one of the things that I definitively established both in my dissertation and my first book and building on the findings of Lester Bush and others is that as far as denying blacks the priesthood, there wasn't, this was not done until after Joseph's death. And even the LDS Church has acknowledged that now, you know, in the statements that have come out, both semi and official, they acknowledge the fact that that it wasn't until after Joseph's death that blacks were denied the priesthood and assigned a second-class status. And so, you know, the doctrines that they were just in the process of beginning to develop. The one thing that started to develop during Kirtland and Missouri period was the idea of being the literal seed of descendants of Ephraim, you know, and this being assigned through patriarchal blessings and that would adversely reflect on blacks who were not assigned the chosen lineage of Ephraim. That was and Armin Moss has documented that very well in the studies that he has done. Let's see. Go ahead. I'll get to you next. Yeah, Kristen. How much time do we have? We're almost running. This last question, unfortunately. Go ahead. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Okay. One is thank you for reading the footnote, because I immediately had a real question of whether to use the Marsh affidavit, and I find it equally problematic and encourage a rethinking. I would love you, I hope the paper talks far more about the slaveholding in Missouri. Charles C. Rich, for instance, we don't think owned a slave in Missouri, but later he was one of the most prominent apostle slave owners, as you know.
Right.
The third thing is there's a lot of religious material, and I would like to have read your first three pages about the people like living in the same area, like Elijah Parrish Lovejoy, and his changing views over that same time. When you do the whole paper, I would encourage, and any comments you have on the other religious movements, which were obviously prime in the anti-slavery movement. Fourth comment is, I find this, you didn't, of course, you're the man who leads us here, but we often say it's either pro-slavery or anti-slavery, pro-slavery or abolitionist. There was a large amount of variation, and people moved up and down this line. The things on Joseph Smith, again, I found quite interesting how you did it, but I encourage you to incorporate any other religious-type people like Elijah Parrish Lovejoy, the Beechers, lots of other people who are walking up and down this same line. And thanks for your presentation.
All right, thank you very much to both speakers.